Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. Gary LeMaster sitting across from me.
Good morning, everyone.
It's a rainy day here in the high desert. It's hard to see the mountains and the edge of the plateau. We have with us today Juan Cole. He's collegiate professor of history at the University of Michigan. It probably best known to the wider public because he started a blog in 2002 called Informed Comment. And it was a source place for everybody interested in Middle Eastern politics, the war in Iraq, and all kinds of people coming from all different directions would be on there. It was great participating in it. He speaks Arabic, modern standard Lebanese and Egyptian dialects, Persian, Urdu, and he reads the Ottoman form of Turkish, and he knows French, German, and Spanish, just like Gary and I do.
Yeah.
Are you there, Professor Cole?
I am.
We're going to talk about your new book, which is called The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. It's a really interesting book. We'll let Professor Cole tell you about it. But I think that and when I wrote Professor Cole, I said even the best American media like the New York Times or something seems to think that the whole millennial generation that led Arab Spring just suddenly disappeared because they lost out in these political struggles. But in fact, Professor, they're still there doing their thing, right? They're still.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So what you say that we think of Arab Spring starting in 2011, correct?
But that's right. Well, late 2010.
Yeah. And, but you tell us about the you have stories about how the movement builds years before that, right?
Oh, sure. Well, you know, the internet comes to the Arab world sort of 1998. It's later than in the West, and it was only one factor in a number of developments that allowed youth activists to get around government censorship, because the government either owned the newspapers or the brother of the president owned the newspapers, and you couldn't get dissident information into them. And likewise with television, for the most part, in-country television. So the internet was greeted by these young people as a way of, first of all, of information gathering, because they could finally, you know, go to international press and find out what's really happening. And second, of sharing it around and then establishing networks and communicating with one another. But of course, the regimes put up cyber police in the early zeros and tracked people down, arrested them. One was charged for illegally using a computer. The other thing that was going on, though, was that there had been these long-term dictatorships, and small parties had been allowed to operate kind of in the shadow of the president's party. But the youth wings of these parties became increasingly unhappy with the prospect of this long-term dictatorship, and started cooperating across party and ideological lines in a way that their parents never would have thought to do. And so beginning, the Iraq War in 2003 was a big reason for demonstrations and networking for these small parties. And the youth attached to them, many of the parties were themselves left or liberal. And those were the youth that tended to spearhead this new wave of activism.
So what's interesting is that the parties, the political parties, seem sort of locked in stone and non-communicative. But something very different happens with the internet and cell phones and stuff. And it means that when there's an election in Egypt, they don't have the muscle of something like the Muslim Brotherhood, right? But it, something different happens when, as you're saying, that people are suddenly talking across lines and different political parties, and there's a whole different way of communicating. Now, it could be exaggerated, but that creates an almost like a reaction, you know, like a chemical reaction that changes underneath many Arab societies.
Yes, I think for the urban activist youth, the internet kind of modeled new forms of cooperation. Because, of course, when you're in a chat group on politics, you can't tell which party the person is from. You might discover you have a great deal in common across those party lines. We have anecdotes of attempts to form broader coalitions or to stage a joint demonstration in which, you know, an older party member will say, well, I would never be in the same room with that guy. And the youth just went around those guys.
And what to say about it? Well, Professor Cole's book has portraits of so many of the game of the young activists played with the cyber police. And the police trying to track them down, arresting them, beating them, driving them into exile. So it's a cat and mouse game to keep. It's not an easy thing to keep these internet connections, these cell phone connections, everything going, right? I mean, the police are on top of them from the very beginning, trying to repress everything, limiting the websites that could be viewed and all the rest.
That's right. In Tunisia, for instance, every time a dissident website popped up, the police would use filters to block it. And so if you were an ordinary internet user, if you went to that site, you would get a 404 not found message. And in fact, the Tunisian youth personified that censor. They called him Amar 404. They made 404 his last name. And they hated him, and after the revolution, they even wanted to find out who he had been so that they could try him.
Because I think it's sort of a cool but also pointed thing to create this kind of mythical creature who is systematically disrupting all your communication and uses 404. And then some of the bloggers at Tunisia, didn't they adopt the variations of the name, like such and such 404, to make fun of the...
Yes, some of them put 404 in their Twitter handles, for instance, as a form of protest. Well, you know, it was personal because you would try to log into your email account and find you'd been locked out of it, or you would discover evidence that messages had been received and deleted, that somebody else was in there with you. And you knew that was a real person. And one of them said, you know, sometimes you had to wait because you knew eventually the guy would go take a cigarette break, and then maybe you could get something done inside your own email box.
I think there's a lot of confusion in the U.S. over what's going on with as a result of Arab Spring. I think that everyone was very optimistic at first, and now I think there seems to be, or at least I read comments from people that, you know, why didn't we support Mubarak and put more money into supporting the dictators? What do you think the future of this is? Well, what is the current, you know, situation, and what do you think the future is of Arab Spring?
Well, I just like to remind people that we're very early in this process. Four presidents for life were overthrown, and they weren't just presidents for life. They were family cartels, and they were intending to put their eldest son or their relative of some sort in power after them. So this was intended to go on for decades. And they're not there anymore, and neither are their sons or other relatives going to be in power. So it's a derailing of a huge elite that was, you know, full of billionaires and movers and shakers and party functionaries. A lot of these people have fled or been put on trial. So these are, you know, real revolutions. And in the course of any revolution, there are ups and downs. There, you know, if you think about the French Revolution, the you know, it was 3 years before they executed the king, and Then the radicals came in for a while, and then there was a right-wing reaction, and then Napoleon declared himself emperor. And, you know, it went on for a while, various permutations, until things finally settled down, probably around 1870. So in the Arab world, why would it be any different? Why would we expect these big changes to eventuate in smooth and sudden transitions?
What's wrong with the American press when Arab Spring didn't turn out to be an easy fix? They just decided that all these young people, and Professor Colebrook makes a really great case for how different this generation, the millennial generation, is from the folks before them, from their parents, in terms of the way they operate in the world. And once the Arab Spring didn't seem to work out right away, I get even from the best media, again, that somehow it all disappeared. But these young people didn't really disappear, right? They're still there. They're still doing their thing, even if they don't run countries.
Well, it was never very likely that any of them would run countries. A lot of them were 22. I mean, these are like American undergraduates. They're not old enough to stand for office. And they were really the ones who spearheaded these revolutions. They were youth movements. And so, yeah, in some countries, they have remained front and center in political developments. In the summer and fall of last year, in 2013, there was a political crisis in Tunisia. The religious right had gotten into power, the Renaissance or Nahda Party, and people were unhappy with how it was crafting the Constitution and its policies. They felt like it was soft on the extremist fundamentalists. So the youth organized and did big demonstrations all around the country, and they hooked up with the major national labor union to put pressure on the government. And they got virtually everything they demanded by January of this year. All of the youth demands really had been met. So the elected government did resign in favor of a technocratic cabinet that would oversee new elections. Parliament passed the Constitution, which has really good provisions for freedom of conscience, freedom of speech. There's no provision for internet censorship. And women and men are considered equal in the law. So the youth, you know, achieved enormous amounts just, you know, last year. And this is not a story that we heard very much about over here.
One of the things I liked about your book was the portrait of the corruption in Egypt and Tunisia. Somehow hearing the details of the corruption, the way that this member of the family got that and that member of the family got this and the bank accounts were hidden here and the money was shifted there. Somehow when we hear that the Egyptian society and Mubarak was corrupt, that's very abstract, but you give a whole series of very pointed details about how the corruption worked. And I think that shows people more why there was this very, very strong revolt against the Mubarak regime.
Yeah, not just Mubarak, but also Ben Ali in Tunisia and the Gaddafis in Libya, Ali Abdullah Saleh in Yemen. They're all very corrupt. And you know, in these societies, businesses operate by being given government licenses to operate or government bids for projects. And so the president would just throw those bids and licenses to his cronies. Increasingly, the sons of the president would throw them to his cronies. So there was a whole new generation of corruption. And you're talking about, you know, economic operations, IPOs, all kinds of things that actually made people into multi-billionaires. In one instance, there was a steel magnate, Ahmed Ez, who it is alleged was given, you know, a tip-off that the state steel mill under neoliberalism was going to be sold off and privatized. So he bought his major competition, and then he stands accused of having gradually robbed the state steel mill of its equipment and fired off a lot of workers and so forth and shifted things so that he became almost a steel monopoly in Egypt. And all of this was done, again, it is alleged, with the favors of the Mubarak family. So economists suggest that the corruption was so great that it scared off international development, aid, and investment. And it may have taken 1 to 3% growth off the annual economic register. So, you know, if Egypt or Tunisia had grown 3% a year more than they did, it might not have been a revolution. The corruption probably was at the root of these upheavals.
Interesting. I was talking with Gary before the show, and he was saying that a lot of the problem was the huge youth, or not problem, but one of the things that set this off was youth unemployment before it. The corruption is at such a level that it actually damages the economy. It's not just a theoretical thing where this guy gets rich. It's damaging the economy.
That's right. They're actually, well, you know, one of the ways these economies could grow is with foreign investment. Direct international investment is one of the indices for a healthy economy. And you can see it, for instance, in Turkey, which really has grown and has attracted a lot of foreign investment. But in the WikiLeaks State Department cables that were released, there's a story about McDonald's coming to Tunis and sniffing around to see whether it's a good place to invest and being hit up for bribes and deciding to go away. And this may actually have been better for the Tunisians' health, but if McDonald's wouldn't come in, then, you know, IBM and all kinds of other companies wouldn't come in. And so it just reduced the amount of capital available, it reduced the growth in jobs. It was a real thing, and it's one of the central demands of the youth movements was that this corruption be ended.
So in Egypt, we've had, and I think the last time we talked to you in January 2013, Morsi was still in power, had just gotten, I think, elected not too long before. And
yeah,
he was
2012.
Sorry?
It would have been... Was it 2012 or 2013? Okay, right. You're saying, well, winter of 2013.
Well, it's when we talked to you. Yeah. And now we see that Morsi is overthrown, and the generals are back in power, and they always were kind of waiting in the wings, right? Has there been any positive change? Because I think people look at Egypt and they think, well, it looks like, I mean, we saw those wonderful demonstrations and the youth power and the bravery of all those young people. And then we got the Muslim Brotherhood in, kind of repressive, not kind of, but repressive government. And then we had it overthrown by the generals. And what's the future in Egypt, you think, of Arab Spring?
Yeah, the way things worked out in Egypt was really unfortunate because the youth had demanded that the country go to free and fair, transparent elections. And the Muslim Brotherhood did very well in those elections. It did do well in part because of cheating, but it was genuinely popular. A certain number of seats, I think a third in 2011, were set aside for independence, and the Muslim Brotherhood was supposed not to run its people in those constituencies, but it did anyway. Of course, those people had party backing and were running against independence, so they won. And so that wasn't fair. But then, you know, a certain proportion of the votes the Muslim Brotherhood got were genuine, and people didn't want the Mubareks back, and there were still a lot of powerful people in Egypt who had been in the Mubarak circle and who wanted to come back. So the Brotherhood benefited from that, and they were seen as not so corrupt. But then their year in office was a huge disaster economically, socially, politically, in every way. They governed from the right. They governed as a small clique. They proved themselves not very good with the economy. They didn't know how things worked in Egypt. And, of course, they hadn't been in power before. They were kind of junior partners in the Mubarak regime in a way, or disliked junior partners. But still, they were part of the old establishment from the point of view of a lot of the youth. And so people were traumatized. I was in Egypt in March, and, you know, people told me that they felt like they had been in jail for a year under the Brotherhood and that they'd been released. So at the moment, the military, which got rid of the Brotherhood and made a coup, it is, I think, genuinely very popular across the board, certainly, I think, has majority support. And a lot of the youth are, I think, cutting it some slack. I mean, they're not very happy with some of the measures that have been taken by the military, but they don't want the Brotherhood back either. And so I think there's a little bit now in Egypt of a honeymoon with the president, Abdel Fattah Sisi, who is a former general, to see where he's going to take the country and what's going to happen. But, you know, if things don't go well, either with regard to continued political repression or with regard to economic advance, then I expect people to be back out in the streets against Sisi in a couple of years.
When you bring up the Muslim Brotherhood, when I, you know, we see ISIS, in Iraq and Syria, I think a lot of Americans who don't pay a lot of attention to the Middle East are concerned that this whole Arab Spring is going to result in more Muslim extremism. What is the role of religion in the Arab Spring?
Well, the vast majority of the youth movements that made the revolutions were secular. They were some of them were leftists. Students for a Democratic Society kind of leftists, and others were liberals with a large L, in the sense of wanting parliamentary democracy. The Muslim Brotherhood and other religious groups didn't play a big role in the revolutions themselves for the most part. But since the youth were demanding that the countries go to parliamentary elections, the religious right had organizational advantages, as it does, you know, in certain parts of the United States as well, and did very, very well in those elections that were held. That's what, you know, produced the backlash in Egypt, and to some extent in Tunisia as well. But, you know, it wasn't a healthy situation in the old days because these dictatorships styled themselves as secular and pro-Western, and then repressed the parties that had a religious tendency. So they just disenfranchised a lot of the population. It would be like, you know, a law passed that the Tea Party is illegal because, you know, so many of them are evangelicals. And that was the kind of thing that was going on over there. And, of course, it created enormous resentments and also likely drove some people towards religious violence and terrorism. So, I mean, I think it was a good thing that things were opened up. And I think Tunisia is an example of where the secular and the religious right have to, you know, have had to try to make big compromises and bargains with one another. Arguably, they've been much more successful in compromising and getting something done than has the secular and the religious right in the United States in the past few years.
Yeah, so, I, when I was growing up in Oklahoma, the fundamentalists, the really hardcore fundamentalists, were really sort of apolitical, or they had just sort of ordinary politics like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentalism was not what I call it weaponized, and have weaponized Islam, and it turned people who are fundamentalists and basically very quiet and not involved in politics into intense, some of them fanatical in involvement.
Yeah, well, you know, people sometimes make various forms of religious and other identity the basis for their politics and get involved in politics on those grounds. And as long as the politics is healthy, then that can be healthy, too. Democracies thrive on diversity. But the dictators were repressing these people to the point where it was pathological. And, you know, I interviewed some of the religious activists in Tunisia, and I said, how did you survive during the Ali years? And they said, how did we survive? We survived in jail, and they were in prison. So this is not, they were prisoners of conscience. They hadn't done anything illegal. They just didn't have the right views. So, you know, I think on the one hand, these upheavals have opened up politics to a wider range of participants, although in Egypt now that's been clamped back down on. But that's not in and of itself a bad thing, and it's not healthy for a significant part of society to be disenfranchised. But then the other thing that's happened in Syria is that the regime responded to the youth protests by throwing up tanks and firing on them, and they drove the protest towards civil war. And then in civil war, you know, the movement gets destroyed, and extremists begin to thrive.
And the longer the civil war in Syria seems to have gone on, the more the extremists have gained power. And when we talk to someone who was from a minority community in Syria, or from Lebanon, but there's a community extended into Syria, they were never excited about the Syrian. They were always skeptical of the attacks and criticism of Assad, because they were afraid that things would go worse for them as a minority group than things were under Assad. And so Assad has, I think, some genuine support from various different minority groups who are more afraid of the extremists than they are of him.
Yes, that dynamic certainly exists, that minorities often favor, the benign dictator, at least benign towards them. But it also has to be said that there's a lot of analysts who think that al-Assad in Syria connived at promoting the rise of the extremists precisely in order to drive people into his camp. So, for instance, until very recently, in the last 18 months, the Syrian army never fought with ISIS, and so they kind of allowed them to flourish. And then they were a standing advertisement for why the rest of the Syrians should keep Bashar around.
What should the United States policy toward ISIS, or I wish they'd get the acronyms correct, ISIL or IS, kind of in line here. What should the United States policy be in Syria and Iraq with the rise of these truly extremist groups?
Well, you know, it's a much more difficult problem than it might seem on the surface, because as you said, in our press discourse, and the politicians in the Beltway, in Washington side the Beltway, you know, they demonize people. And so, Mosul rose up against the government in Baghdad and embraced the so-called Islamic State, or IS, in early June. And now, you know, a lot of Western politicians and pundits say that they have to be bombed. But you have to stop and ask yourself, well, why was the cosmopolitan and secular city of Mosul so unhappy with the government imposed on them by the Americans that they even were willing to let IS into their territory? And I think, you know, the idea of the U.S. giving close air support to the Kurds and to the Iraqi government army, which frankly has a lot of fanatical Shiite militiamen fighting alongside it, is not a bad idea if it's defensive. But if the idea is to have them conquer Sunni Mosul, then that's going to be a Shiite Kurdish, you know, attack on the city. And it's politically very, very bad.
And ISIS or ISIL has seems to have collected a bunch of Sunni tribes who are not really part of their ideology, but they're part of being Sunni in the Sunni Shiite split. And so you're, in attacking them, you're attacking people who are not necessarily hardcore members of ISIL, right? And that could be a problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way that President Obama speaks, he's aware of this problem, and I think what they're hoping to do is find a way of detaching some of the Sunnis from IS and then involving them in the attempt to defeat it. But that's a tall order. I mean, that's counterterrorism or counterinsurgency of a very sophisticated type that seems to me awfully difficult to pull off.
Let's turn to Gaza. Yet another massive attack on Gaza, and Hamas is being blamed for starting it by kidnapping and murdering three young settlers on the West Bank. What do you have to say about that? This is when was the last one? 2006, Cast Lead or whatever it was called, and now we have a new one.
Well, in Gaza, the recent conflicts have been 2008, 2009. That was Cast Lead, and then there was a short conflict in late 2012.
So, what can you tell us about this? Because, you know, when I look at it, and it seems to me that the Israeli response to resistance, armed resistance, is always to punish the people around the armed resistors. So when they go into Lebanon, they blow up whole neighborhoods of people who might be supporting the fighters, because if you kill the fighter, he gets replaced by his brother or his uncle or if you destroy a whole neighborhood, you can intimidate people into not doing it. They blew up bridges in northern Lebanon that had absolutely nothing to do with the conflict. And in Gaza, it looks like they basically leveled every positive thing in this impoverished little enclave.
Yeah. That's right. The ruling Likud party is rooted in the philosophy of Vladimir Jabotinsky, who is a Central European thinker of the early 20th century and, frankly, deeply influenced by the mass movements of the 1930s, the fascist movements. And he was aware that, you know, the Palestinians were not going to willingly surrender their homes and turn over their country to the Zionist settlers, and he developed a philosophy of what he called the Iron Wall, which was that, you know, the settler community in British Palestine would have to throw up this wall of violence around themselves and just flatten anybody who gave them any trouble. So this is, you know, you described the tactics, but this is philosophical. This is something the Likud party is invested in as a matter of founding texts of the party. As a philosophy, it had some successes, I think it's reached the end of its successes because of a number of factors. For one thing, the rest of the world is not going to put up with it forever, and you know, the real problem here is this conflict in Gaza. It was a horrible thing, but it was episodic. But what is the end game here? You have 1.8 million people in the Gaza Strip. They're surrounded by Israel. They don't have an airport. They don't have a port. The Israelis don't let them export most of what they produce. They're in this huge kind of economic and political jail. And the Israelis say, well, they could get out of it if they just acquiesce. But acquiesce in what? 70% of them were expelled from what is now Israel. They lost their homes, their land, their property. They received no compensation whatsoever for it. 40% of them are still living in refugee camps. Nobody's going to acquiesce in that situation and just say, okay, well, we'll pretend we're starting from zero now. And so you see these Israeli spokesmen come out and say that Gaza could be Singapore if only it would make peace. But, you know, it's asking refugees and displaced people and people who are stateless to acquiesce in what was done to them with no compensation, And they have very little capital, and there's no prospect whatsoever of them being Singapore. Even if they did make peace, they would just be poor. So they are resisting this situation, and there's no Israeli plan for dealing with that resistance except what they call mowing the lawn, you know, killing people from time to time, leveling neighborhoods and so forth to hope to, you know, barely keep them in line.
Interestingly, I saw a poll last week that following the conflict, the most recent conflict, that it had an effect of turning many more of the Gazans towards Hamas, exactly the opposite of what Israel proclaims it wants. I'd like to turn back to the broader region, if I could.
Let me follow up on Gaza just for a minute, Gary.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you what you thought on this. And I remember talking to young Israeli soldiers decades ago. And they seemed much more aware of the ambiguities of what they were doing to the Palestinians than their American supporters. They seemed to know the dark side of what they were doing, that they were displacing people and that they were killing people. And that didn't mean that they didn't support what they were doing, but it showed an ambiguity. And what we see now in Israel is this massive shift to the far right, where the peace movement's collapsed. There's this hardening of the Israeli point of view. There's a lack of being able to see the other side. At least that's my impression. What is yours?
I think there's still a lot of unease among young Israelis who are put in the military and made to essentially commit war crimes. But as you say, the general Israeli political tendency has shifted to the right. This is, you know, Israel is an extremely dynamic society, and what Israel is now is very different than it was 30 years ago, because in the 90s, you had about a million people come in from the former Soviet Union and Ukraine. And many of those, are only very distantly Jewish, and about 300,000 of them weren't Jewish at all. And they brought with them, kind of Eastern European ways of thinking about ethnic conflict, and we saw what happened in the former Yugoslavia. So, they weren't the people who came in the 1920s and the Ashkenazi settlers and the people who learned some Arabic and who, you know, have a long history here. They've been there for 15 years, and they want what they can get.
Turning back to the region as a whole, I'd be curious your thoughts on what the new Arab impact would be on the oligarchies such as Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, you know, there were some demonstrations in some of the oil monarchies during 2011, but they couldn't gain any traction, and they gradually either were repressed or fizzled out. These are also very young societies. Saudi Arabia has an enormous youth bulge, but they're also enormously wealthy societies. So in Kuwait, the emir in 2011 simply announced a grant to every Kuwaiti of $2,500.
I'm going to buy you off.
very, very explicitly. You know, I guess you could get a really nice home theater system for about $2,500. So, you could have a revolution, or you could have a home theater. And they seem to have gone for the home theater. So, in Saudi Arabia as well, enormous money was put into social programs. You know, Saudis have access to free health care, to education for free through the PhD. They get access to 3% home mortgage loans, maybe less now, and can often have fairly large homes. And, you know, the Saudis, as far as I can tell, have $750 billion in currency reserves just lying around. They don't need that to run the government or anything. And then they have another $750 billion in their sovereign wealth fund, which invests, you know, like in Spain and around the world. So I figure they have $1.5 trillion in walking around money. This is beyond what's needed to, you know, build roads and run the government and so forth. And so the ability of the state to, as you say, essentially bribe people to buy into it and stay politically quiet is very substantial and probably much more important than the repression, which also exists. You know, people who step out or become dissidents are often whipped and jailed and so forth. But it's not necessary to do that to most people because the handouts are so attractive.
So what do you think is going to happen? And Gary, move the question to a broader thing. What's going to happen with what are the millennials in the Arab world going to do next? How are they going to impact society in the future? We've seen what they can do to an extent in the past. We've got 3 minutes. so you have a 2-minute answer because we have an announcement.
Sure. Well, you know, in many ways, my book was not, despite the subtitle, about the millennials in general, but about the youth movements that were erected in hopes of representing the millennials and, you know, achieving their aspirations, speaking for them, and so forth. And they were all called youth movements. You know, in the West, we called the people who rose up rebels, but in Arabic, they always said youth rebels. And the middle-aged and old people weren't that involved. There were, you know, they did come out when the youth called them, but it was the youth that was really leading this. So I think these youth movements are going to continue to, you know, they were very important formative bodies for politics. And so we'll be seeing their members gradually get into office over the next 20 and 30 years. Many of them, as you mentioned, have values of transparency, interest in freedom of speech and democracy, and less interested in religion. Very different values than their parents. So I think over the next 20 and 30 years, they're going to create a very different kind of Middle East.
I suggest everyone check out Professor Cole's book. It has very vivid portraits of the young people involved in the struggle to improve things in the Arab world. It has kind of detail that I find really enriching. It's gotten, of course, extremely good reviews.
And the title again is "The New Arabs: How the Millennial Generation Is Changing the Middle East."
And so we want to thank you for being with us, Professor Cole, and we hope people will check out the book and check out your blog, Informed Comment, which began in like 2002. Thank you very much for being with us. We have one small announcement before the end of the show. Door is having a picnic on Sunday, September 14th, up at the Living Springs Camp in Oak Creek Canyon. We have U.S. Representative Ann Kirkpatrick speaking, the head of the AZ Democratic Party, Felicia Ronaridi, who's running for Attorney General, the candidates for Corporation Commission, Tom O'Halloran, who's running as an independent for State Senate. It's basically a 4th of July picnic, not on the 4th of July. You know, it's cake and ice cream and hot dogs and hamburgers and political speeches and auctions and sales. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.